What would I do if I didn't have you to love me? Dave Pettigrew on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning, 75 degrees, sunshine outside, gorgeous day here locally. And Dr. Don Clark now joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. And I note that you have very high humidity down your way, Don. Is it hot and humid down there?
It is warm and humid. It's a little bit cooler this morning, but the temperatures have started to go up again.
Yeah, I think the whole country seems. I know there's still heat advisories through portions of Oklahoma and Missouri, and I happened to be down in Kentucky a couple of weeks ago and saw a lot of brown Kentucky bluegrass, which was really disastrous for the horse ranches and farms around there. And in Arkansas is brown and dry. Missouri, I guess, has really been hard hit by this combination of heat and humidity and drought, and I guess now it's dipping down to Texas too. Although you've had heat and dryness for a few years now, haven't you?
Oh, we have, but this year hasn't been anything like last year. Mm. I mean, last year it was 104 plus for months, and which was very unusual. This year it's in the upper 90s. It's getting into the 90s. Yesterday it got up to 100 plus, but. Hopefully it won't stay that way.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to take, especially up here in Minnesota. We've been in the 90s, and here you don't come to Minnesota for heat. You just don't. So well, we're coping, though. We're getting through it. Interesting lead you gave me yesterday on Lucy. Now, we're not talking Lucille Ball here. We're talking kind of a missing link, kind of a creature that has been thought to be, said to be, touted to be somewhere between apes and humans. And this results from a find that goes back to 1974. And I had kind of forgotten about Lucy, but apparently there's more discoveries, more recent discoveries connected with Lucy. And you being a biochemist, a good position to give us the science behind this. What's going on with Lucy these days?
Well, yes, Lucy, or more scientifically known as Australopithecus afarensis. The fossils were found in 1974 by Donald Johansson, and from the time that he found the fossils, he said, "Oh, wow, this has got to be a new discovery," and it's this particular creature must have walked on 2 feet. As opposed to being hunched over and walking on the knuckles like an ape would.
Now, what would have led him to that conclusion?
Well, there were a couple of things. I mean, his enthusiasm for trying to find a missing link, I think, was the biggest one. But in 1976, Mary Leakey, related to the famous Leakey that we... Mm-hmm. Well, some of us who are older know about.
Oh, Lewis.
Margaret.
Lewis Leakey.
Found in Laetoli, Tanzania, about 1,000 miles away, footprints that resembled human footprints, bare human footprints. This was of 2 or 3 or 4 humans or human-like creatures that got fossilized, basically. And so Johansson jumped on the bandwagon and said, "Wow, okay." And they found some skeleton similar to Lucy's skeleton in the area. So he connected the dots and said, you know, it was creatures like Lucy that made the footprints.
I mean, they found more creatures like Lucy in the area of the footprints, 1,000 miles from Lucy's find.
Well, yes, they found skeleton, skeleton remains of these creatures. And so Mary Leakey had her discovery dated, and it was something like 3.6 million years ago. And Johansson had his fossil dated, and it was like 3.2 million years ago.
Yeah, so is this radiocarbon dating again?
No, radiocarbon dating is not going to get you that far back. Okay. So it was isotopic dating. Okay. With Leakey, it was probably just the strata that the footprints were found in.
Okay.
So it had no dating method other than, okay, the footprints are in this layer, so therefore they got to be X number of years old.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that kind of led credence to Johannes's work, and obviously not a very scientific conclusion, because you find bones lying around footprints doesn't necessarily mean that the bones that you find were actually made by those those creatures.
A long leap, so to speak.
Yeah, but the greatest, probably the greatest discovery and the telltale kind of punchline of Lucy actually happens to be in her hips, and the iliac, which is the hip bone, if you will. The blades of the hip, where the glutamus attaches to, are different whether you walk upright like we do, or whether you're ape-like. And if you walk upright, the iliac blade is kind of fanned out, so it allows the muscle in the leg basically to be able to move in a more upright position. If it's ape-like, the wings are actually tilted inward, and guess what Lucy's turned out to be?
Ape-like is my guess.
Yes, very much ape-like.
Would they now were these hips found at the same time? Because I'm understanding that there were other bones or parts of similar creatures found more recently that may have shed light on Lucy.
Well, the hips were found pretty early, and then no feet or hand bones were found at the time Johansson found them.
But they must have known that hips of an ape would be constructed differently, shaped differently than something a creature that walks upright in 1974. That should have been at their fingertips, right? I mean, they would.
Absolutely.
So they ignored that evidence, apparently.
He did. Hmm. Yes. In the enthusiasm to say that this is a pre-human, a lot of paleontologists, will stretch the data to say, okay, this looks like could be.
Mm-hmm.
And the story even gets a little bit more humorous, but let's go back to other findings. The more recent findings were that they did find some feet bones and some hand bones. And the hand bones, especially the knuckles, were more very much ape-like. Because if you're walking on the ground, you're going to have very strong fingers and knuckles, and you're going to be basically walking on your knuckles and your fingers. And so that's what, Lucy, the bone similar to Lucy's turned out to be. So there was no doubt that Lucy was an ape and not a humanoid. That didn't stop another fellow, however, and this was actually on a public television broadcast, that he took a cast of the iliac wing or the hip bone, and at least the pieces that were found, for Lucy. And he said, well, all these were put together wrong. And so he took a cast of each piece, which there were about three of them, and then started to grind them down so that they would actually fit together like a human.
My goodness. Ignorance or fraud, I wonder.
Yeah, well, and then he said, oh, well look, it's human-like. Mm-hmm. After all, the original piecing together of the hip bone was incorrect.
Now, was this recently done?
Oh, I think it was in the 80s. Let me see if I can find it. I think it was in the 80s.
Decades ago then, okay.
Or 90s. So, yeah, folks just will go to, and this is Lovejoy, who actually did this wonderful masterpiece of science. And
he's an artist, though. You got to give him that.
Yeah, and if you go to the museum, Natural History Museum in Chicago, you will see Lucy upright, an ape upright, walking like. So it doesn't take much for these folks just to use their imagination and give you a picture that, okay, here's exactly what this, pre-man or pre-human, looked like.
Well, is science defending their original conclusions, or have they yielded to this more recent finding? With the knuckles and the hands, have they changed their opinion to Lucy, or is Lucy still a sidetrack to what they're looking to? I mean,
well, that's an interesting question, because it's obviously the exhibit in the Chicago Museum is still there, and you would think that if we found that this is incorrect, we should take it down. They haven't taken it down. It's been known for some time that Lucy is actually an ape, or either a chimpanzee or belonging to a smaller, kind of baboon or not a gorilla, type family. Different than anything that we have today. But okay, so Lucy's extinct. It doesn't make her a hominid, bipedal hominid that was claimed, and the evidence is absolutely clear that Lucy is not a in the lineage, if you will, of man.
And of course, in some of the artistic renderings of what Lucy supposedly looked like, they've given her kind of a human look, haven't they?
No, they have.
I mean, the artist that is in charge of that. I mean, there had to be some rather large assumptions in putting together her actual appearance.
Yeah, and so how do you justify? I mean, okay, you take liberty, and draw things as you think that it would be, or as you're being told. Maybe the artist wasn't, was being told exactly what to draw. But at some point in time, you have to actually come to the conclusion that Lucy is a knuckle walker is not this human, the pre-human that we thought she was originally.
So we can see that the museum folks haven't gotten the message. At least they have not been motivated to change the public image of Lucy. But what about science in general, paleontology or whatever branch of science deals with this? Are they saying, we were wrong? Or are they just kind of ignoring the new evidence, which is my guess?
And before you get to that answer, Don, how new is this particular line of thought?
What do you mean?
When did people start saying this publicly, or was there a research report written, or somebody's filed worked on a postdoc paper, or was there? I mean, isn't that the way things usually happen? If there is a theory that continues on from some time in the past and will continue on until somebody files either a counter theory or a theory that disputes it.
Yeah, publications about Lucy has been coming out from time to time. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, there was a lot of things going on, and even in the 2000s, in the 2000s, information still comes out basically saying that Lucy is not a humanoid. So with this information, it doesn't get public, though. You see,
public perception
that's the key.
Is still as it was.
Yeah, because I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, And Wikipedia says that one of Lucy's most striking characteristics is a valgus knee, which indicates that she was moving upright. And it, you know, the page also says that her femoral head was small, a femoral neck was short, greater trochanter, however, was clearly derived in short and human-like. I mean, so Wikipedia hasn't gotten it, and I don't know that. Yeah, I mean, there's academic circles, and you know, most people don't get to be to hang out with in the hallowed halls of learning and, you know, the PhD studies. But this is Wikipedia. This is where the public gets involved in adding or subtracting to the knowledge base, and nobody's added anything, or nobody's changed this particular look at. You know, it's a very public look at this specific thing.
Right. And Wikipedia, I mean, you you can't just add things to Wikipedia anymore. You know, you have to be, yes, you have to be approved. Mm-hmm. And what you add, of course, you know, can be edited and can be edited out.
Sure.
So it's not this unbiased publication that we were all hoping that it would be. It too has a slant, and it's obviously a slant to evolution.
Well, so, you just told me that Santa Claus is dead. I mean, this is terribly disappointing.
Well, he's just wounded. We're just wounded, David.
Well, he'll be okay. He's just injured. Maybe he's not dead, yeah. But. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, this really opens up a larger question, and that would be, what's the responsibility that science has to correct wrong first impressions? I mean, you understand how mistakes can be made. You can go off on a tangent and get carried away with your enthusiasm. But once there's evidence to the contrary, shouldn't science or the scientist or the institution that discovers it make an equal effort to correct the public record?
I think they should, but in defense of science, at least when I was doing science back, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 70s and 80s, basically, the scientists were more ethically honest,
uh-huh.
at least most. So if there was an error, if you wrote a paper and then you did further experiments and found that, that really wasn't, that was a fluke and I couldn't repeat it, and so here's the new results and it says something different, you wrote the editor, or you wrote another paper to the same journal and basically said, my earlier data was flawed, here's the new data, and it shows something different.
Mm-hmm.
That apparently does not hold anymore, especially when you talk about human origins. It's as if there is something driving this engine. And of course, we know what that is, and that's the enemy of our soul,
mm-hmm.
that is keeping the truth not only in scientific publications, although, you know, some of this information we've been talking about are in scientific arenas, but certainly keeping it from the public. It would not surprise me to see textbooks, you know, written about Lucy. Where the information is not corrected, that information will stay in there, until someone's, you know, jumps up and down and says, "Hey, this is fraudulent. This has been proven for eons, basically, and you have to basically get the public involved in order to get these things changed."
Yeah, does the public care enough? I mean, there are elements of the public, creationists, young earth creationists, and people that believe much as we do, who might get excited enough to make public statements about it. But the public as a whole, I think, I'm afraid, could care less. This needs to be made sensationally news to people in order to hopefully correct that first misimpression. But it's old news now. You know, how do you get their attention again with Lucy? And we need a myth-busting organization of some kind, you know, a TV show.
Yeah. Well, okay. Here in Texas, since Texas is a very large state, and the textbooks editors and publishers come to Texas first with their new textbooks. Hmm. And in Texas, yeah. We have organizations that do just that. I mean, I was part I guess it was probably about 7 years ago. The textbooks get reviewed every 10 years. So, you know, this year might be history, next year might be biology, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it goes on a cycle, and you get through every 10 years, you've gone through all of the curriculum, all the textbooks in Texas. And so I reviewed one of the science textbooks and actually talked about the information related to the Mueller experiment, where he took, he was a student who took methane and electrical charge and some carbon, CO2, and mixed them all together, and voila, you get something that looks like amino acids. You get some very primitive amino acids, mm-hmm. and then you get some that are not racemically correct. So you've got, for example, amino acids are... amino acids in your body are all L, and that just means that the side chain is pointing in one direction. But in that particular experiment, you got a mixture of both R and the L. So you had some that were on the right, the correct side, and you had those that were on the left. And it was a chemistry experiment. And everybody thought that, okay, this the conditions on the Earth had to be methane-rich. Well, that's turned out for 50 years to be incorrect. Mm-hmm. And it's been known for 50 years, and yet here it was still in the textbooks. And I pointed that out to the school board here in Texas, and they said, well, okay, we need to really look into this. They give you 3 minutes.
No.
And when I was talking with them, they gave me 15. And they kept, as long as they kept asking questions, you can be up there, you know, answering the questions as they ask them. And so finally they concluded, well, you know, take that textbook back, and we need to take out the inaccuracies in the textbook. But there was no follow-up with the school board to say that job was actually done. Mm-hmm. So there are loopholes, even when you have a very strong advocacy group for, you know, truth in textbooks, and the opposition is so deceptive that even when, you know, told let's correct things, they'll just kind of push it under the rug and say, well, okay, well, we can't really do this, or we won't do this, or we'll change some things, but we'll leave other things in.
So is it a matter then of intellectual integrity? There are people who will lie, cheat, and steal to make sure that the information stays the same, or even once they know it's in error in their hearts, that they're probably economically tied to the old solutions?
Well, they're certainly spiritually tied to the old solutions,
okay.
And morally tied, and mm-hmm. and so it becomes a religion to them, their belief system. And if you shake their belief system, then you know they can't take any other answer.
Could we call evolution a religion then? It's certainly not science.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, it is a religion, because you anything that you put your faith in, you can say, well, that's a form of religion. And so if you put your faith in something, what is faith? Faith is the evidence of things not seen, mm-hmm. but evidence of things hoped for, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we don't see any evidence for evolution, but we hope it's true, because if it isn't true, then the alternative is that there is a God, and then I am responsible to that God.
Excellent point. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's lots of examples of people having economic interests very definitely tied to these these wrong-headed notions, or the, you know, that people know they're false but continue on anyway. The most recent example that pops into my mind is global warming, and there are all kinds of people out there who have got a lot of money to gain, a lot of money, prestige. Entire careers have been built on this notion that human beings have caused the planet to heat up. And I mean, I don't think there's anybody is suggesting that we're going to take Al Gore's Oscar back just because now we have serious doubts whether there was human connection. You know, that's just, you know, we tend to, as human beings, I think, tend to elevate certain people on the basis of whatever the hot topic of the moment comes. And we don't want to be proven wrong because we'll be made to look stupid. You know, so I mean, there's almost like a natural defense of the current, of the hot thing. I remember reading the book on Lucy, you know, that Johansson wrote. I think it was in the early 90s sometime. And, you know, very, very interesting book. I wasn't schooled enough in the specifics of the things you're talking about to know or to see that there was a lot of things missing. And I think I remember being struck by the notion when I was reading the book that there didn't seem to be a lot of bones there. And
the original finding, there weren't a lot of bones.
Yeah. And I kept saying to myself, I remember now, kept saying to myself, have we gotten to the point where we can't find all of the stuff, all of the pieces, so we have to make a lot of conjecture on the basis of a toenail? Mm-hmm. Or a tooth. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we make assumptions on the basis of how long the tooth was. And everybody knows that if you're long in tooth, well, that means you're pretty old, but I digress. How long did it take the archaeological anthropological hoax that I remember was the Piltdown man. Back in the 20s, that there was a guy that was shown to have taken, you know, large pieces of one human being and put it on another human being, or they made plaster casts or something. But it was an obvious hoax. How long did that take to become known in the general public? Do you remember?
Well, it was at least 30 years.
Yeah.
And it was known that it was a hoax, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years after.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes a very long time for misinformation, you know, to get corrected. And it's like anything, you have to keep repeating it over and over again. And through organizations like, you know, Creation Moments and Answers in Genesis and Creation Research Institute, I mean, that's our goal, is to educate the public as to what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not afraid of the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if the truth is pointing in some direction, there must be a logical reason for it.
And part of it is not just, it's not really a matter of integrity, I think, because they've done research to determine how long it takes for a story to become legendized, that is, to be ingrained in the culture as kind of a collective memory, regardless of accuracy. And they've done that with New Testament scripture. And they've gone back and said, well, the Gospels were written quickly enough after Christ's ministry that they had not become mm-hmm. inflated and distorted through legend and folklore and so forth. And so the time when the information was created in relation to the original discovery is of great, great consequence to the understanding, the proper understanding or the misunderstanding of the public as a whole. And you mentioned Piltdown Man, and I'm sure there are lots of other legends, Loch Ness Monster and so forth, that we could say, well, there's enough time passed now that it's locked into our collective memories, rightly or wrongly. You can't change it. So it takes a mountain of new evidence and sensationally presented to change that that first impression.
Well, in the case of, for example, the Scopes trial, all it took to twist the truth was a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That distorted the actual truth. The truth was that the case was won overwhelmingly for creation, But from the movie, you get the idea that the fellow, you know, the lawyer that was representing creation was a buffoon. Mm-hmm. And whereas the lawyer representing
the biologist was
this very intelligent, you know, so you had intelligence versus, you know, the old traditions of folklore type of thing.
Now, isn't it interesting that that movie involved, well, not the movie, but the reality, involved a Chicago lawyer on the side of evolution. Clarence Darrow,
Clarence Darrow came from Chicago,
yeah,
eh?
He did.
I remember having a discussion about this with a local theater director, and he put on Inherit the Wind, and they did the same blatant stereotypes of the characters as the movie did. I mean, in fact, the play was written after the movie was produced, and you know, then it became a staple of a lot of you know, high school and college plays, and you know, community theater plays and stuff. And you know, I showed him, you know, an example. I mean, it didn't take all that much. I think a quick Google search, and I, you know, pulled out the original story, and that the story was written by a guy from, I think it wasn't it from the Chicago newspaper. I think it was from the Sun-Times or the Times, and then had demonstrated that he had gone down with the notion that he wanted to portray these characters thus and so, and they were actually looking for a biology teacher to challenge
this particular
law. Yeah,
it was set up. It was Scopes was recruited to make the case for.
Right. And all of this, and I gave him a copy of this information. He said. He says, "Well, I'm just working with a script here, and I'm going to stick with it."
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't apply to any other thing he's ever done. This particular guy, this is the same guy that will say, "Hey, I don't think I like that line. Let's leave it."
David, you're making waves. David.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
a small divergence. I was on the stage with this particular director one time, and he said. He says, "Dave, could you move a little bit further to your right?" This is in rehearsals. And then he paused and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry. You're about as far right as you can get."
Oh, my goodness.
And about half of the cast laughed because they understood it. The other cast has no idea what he's talking about.
A bone of contention, which brings us back to Lucy. Yeah, the bones of contention more recently found kind of destroying the original thinking, the hope, the misinformation, as it turns out. That was put out, and the question becomes, how can that be corrected? Will it ever be corrected? And Dr. Don, you were talking about textbooks. Are they still using that graphic designer's invention of monkeys slowly moving into an upright position and becoming modern man, that progression from left to right across the piece of paper? Is that still present in textbooks? Do you know?
I'm not 100% sure whether or not it is, but clearly it's in great error, and it's in the imagination of man that creates these things. But the Huckel diagram of the embryos, you know, going from looking like a fish and then going through and looking like, you know, chicken and eventually into man, the theory that embryonic recapitulation, that is, we relive our evolutionary history, has been proven for eons. I mean, 50, 60 years, that it was incorrect. Mm-hmm. And that Huckel himself fudged the drawings, and the sizes, were all out of whack. Was not a human embryo at all, but yet those were still in the textbooks that I was reviewing, not that long ago. Mm-hmm. They were still in there.
Well, then here's kind of a metaphysical question. We've talked about these drawings sticking in the public imagination and creating impressions that are in error. We've talked about the movie Inherit the Wind, which is what, 1960s it was made, trumping the original trial and the actual information that went on. Is art more powerful than science?
Well, it is, from the point of view that, one, it captures the emotion, and it's tantalizing to our to our minds and to our ears. It's one of those things that tickles our ears, if you will, or our eyes, for that matter. And so if you can put it, and this is the scary thing about today, if you can put it into a film that the public you know, wants to go see, you have reached so many more people than you ever possibly will in a scientific journal. And even if the information is correct in the scientific journal, it doesn't matter. And those people making films will use artistic liberty to tell whatever story they want to tell. And so, you know, the kids, our kids, you know, pick up this misinformation and then begin to think that whatever's in the movies is reality. And that's a very, very dangerous, dangerous thing.
Well, here's kind of a collateral question then. Are dreams or imaginations or psychological longings and cravings closer to spirit than the physical?
I believe they are. And I believe that we get not only you know, voices in our head, ideas come from three places. Either they're our own, and this has to do with dreams as well, and visions, which is you just have a dream in the daytime and you're still awake, but they come from three. Either they're our own, or they come from God, or his helpers, the angels, or they come from Satan or his helpers. And all three, I mean, obviously God can communicate. God communicates with us through our spirit. The enemy has the same mode of communicating with us, is through our spirit. The problem comes in is we don't discern. We can't figure out which is who is speaking to us, and oftentimes we think it's our own when it's not. So when you have dreams, the nighttime is a good time for the enemy's for his playground, and we know that most crimes are done at night versus during the day. And so who is driving these people to commit these crimes, whether it be, you know, theft or whether it be something, you know, these massacres that that we've, you know, seen, and recently, unfortunately, the massacre that we've heard about in Aurora, Colorado. You have to ask yourself, who is driving this person? Because what they did was unnatural. And so if it was unnatural, it had to be some type of supernatural event. And someone was driving this person. Now, we don't like to think about the spiritual because we can't see it. But if we're honest with each other, we have to realize that we are influenced by spiritual things. And some of the ministries I work with, we do ministry in Africa. The Africans are very spiritual people. And so they understand the spirit a lot better than we do here in the West. We have this Greek thinking which says A follows B, B follows A, and which leads to C, and so things are linear. That's not true for most of the world. Where the thinking is more, you know, in tuned to, the spirit world influences us. Now, unfortunately, a lot of folks, you know, in Africa are influenced spiritually by the wrong side, and so you have such things as voodoo, where they're actually the practice of voodoo is actually trying to conjure up a demonic being inside the person or people, you know, practicing voodoo. Now, they think that this is a good thing. Now, obviously, it's not.
Well, and I think human beings everywhere, though, have the same susceptibility because we have the same appetite, the same desire, the same hunger for knowledge of God. And we're given substitutes by those wrong sources. But we receive it so openly and so eagerly that we can easily be led down the garden path and in the wrong direction. So having a standard to appeal to, like Scripture, becomes essential, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And not only do we have the Scriptures, but those who believe in our Lord Jesus Christ have His Spirit indwelling within us. Mm-hmm. So that Spirit then protects us and also, you know, leads us. Jesus said that He will send His Spirit to lead us and guide us into all truth.
David?
There's so many different directions. Oh, man. Can we go on for about 3 weeks on this?
Oh, why not?
Is that okay? Why not?
Don's going to have to order another muffin sooner or later.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I'd like to get one myself. Carol forgot to buy the Thomas muffins this week.
Uh-oh.
Tragic. I'm going in withdrawal. It's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. I'm reading the Harry Potter series. I've never read the Harry Potter books, and then once I'm finished with the books, I want to see the movies and, you know, and just examine. And I've heard, I haven't really read all that much about it, but that I've heard that there's something obviously very spiritual about the way that the character is presented. And Harry Potter is the good guy, and then he faces the evil guy, and they use magic spells back and forth and all the rest of that. But, you know, some have written that there is a deeper spiritual positive meaning within the Harry Potter series. I've never heard Rowling say that. I've never heard anybody credible say that beyond somebody's, you know, conjecture. And I'm just wondering what you think.
Well, I think the Harry Potter series is it's just pure witchcraft. And there is a very strong spiritual message behind it, but unfortunately, mm-hmm. it's coming from the kingdom of darkness and not the kingdom of light.
It's so, not a good sense.
Yeah, okay. And so the you know, in Wicca, there's such a thing as, you know, white witches and mm-hmm. dark witches, black right. witches, basically. And the white witches practice in quote good witchcraft, and the dark witches practice, of course, the evil witchcraft. It's all evil. So, you know, using that, it's teaching the kids to try out and experiment in the spiritual world. Unfortunately, it's the negative spiritual world.
Kind of like playing with fire, huh?
Exactly.
Mm, yeah.
What continues to amaze me, and you know, it's not just these this series, but other series. And you know, in my, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the Star Wars series, but how, and I'm not saying that there's any correlation between the Star Wars series and the understanding and manipulation of the Force, and which has, you know, very, very definite religious overtones, but how these kinds of fictional pursuits can reach such a wide audience so quickly. And so, I mean, because, I mean, it's like there is no formula for writing these kinds of stories, but some of them just succeed way beyond anybody's imagination, whereas some guy working away in obscurity will write a book and four people will read it. But overnight, J.K. Rowling became a wild success. And, you know, and she hadn't any history of that. You know, likewise with George Lucas.
Well, could it be because we have this continuing appetite for things spiritual that we may not even be able to identify it, but
probably,
we're open to those things.
Mm.
Yeah,
very probably.
Yeah. And both of those are very spiritual, and both of them, unfortunately, are very spiritually in the dark direction. Mm-hmm. We have a tremendous appetite.
And it's a black mark on the modern church that it's not filling that for people generally.
Mm. That's exactly right.
Hmm. Really?
You see, and when Jesus came, he came in spirit and truth and in power. You know, he told the Pharisees, well, look, if you don't believe me, if you don't believe my words, if you don't believe my Father's words, then believe those things that I have done. The miracles, the signs, the wonders, you know, he came in power. Mm-hmm. And if the church doesn't have the power that Jesus had, he left it with us to be caretakers of it, then why should the world believe us, really? I mean, it's scary to think about that.
It is. It is. This has been a far-ranging discussion. It's been a delight. But I think I think probably the proprietor of the coffee shop where Dr. Don is this morning is probably about ready to move on to the lunch hour.
Or sell him a new muffin.
We've taken up a lot of your time, almost a whole hour this morning. Don, we're so appreciative. And we started talking about Lucy, and we went in a lot of directions, but it's all been productive and all been fascinating. We'll look forward to chatting with you again next Monday. Dr. Don Clark, a member of the board of Creation Moments. It's creationmoments.com is the website. And it's just what it says it is, Creation Moments. It's about God's creation, how it all got started, how it happened. And you can find a wealth of resources there on the website at creationmoments.com. You can link to them from brokenroadradio.com. We hope you will. And also, he's a biochemist, and he's gracious with his presence every Monday during our 8 o'clock hour Central Time. Don, we're so grateful to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure again. And yes, we go in multiple directions, but it's been good.
Well, that's what makes conversation fun. I think it really is. Music continues now on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning with Steve Bell. Good morning to you.